You're listening to TFM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading in case I got bored.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Literary Treks, TFM's local books and comics show. I am just one of your hosts, Casey Pettit, and with me, as he always is Jonathan Cohn. Jonathan,
hey,
how are you feeling?
You know, personally, not so great. Still having that cold season flu, but you know what? We're wrapping up school with my students and getting ready for a break to read lots of books, which I'm excited about.
Yeah. And we've got a doozy to talk about today with the Star Trek, the original series book, Identity Theft. Mm-hmm. And we will be joined in just a little bit with Greg Cox.
Or someone that we believe is Greg Cox.
Or someone that we believe is, someone pretending to doing a very good impression of Greg Cox.
Maybe we're really talking to Dayton and Greg's in the green room this time.
Oh, no. I mean, it would be great to talk to Dayton, but
we have to wait another 4 months.
Yeah. We got to wait for his book to come out, but... Well, yes. Before we do that, though, I want to let everybody know how they can get in touch with us and remind everybody that you can find all of our shows by going to our website at trek.fm, and you can follow us on X and Instagram at trek.fm. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trek.fm, and while you're there, join our listeners-only group, the Babel Conference. Just go to the Facebook search field and type B-A-B-E-L, and it should come right up. And we also have a dedicated Goodreads group for Literary Treks, which I always intend to get into, and I just don't do so good at it. I need to do better. Ping me, people. Tell me to get on there. But I'm always in Goodreads. But yes, let's strike up some conversations there. Join us there, and you can see the books we've read and even what's coming up next. And if you'd like to support the network, we'd very much appreciate that. Please go to patreon.com/trekfm, where you can select from any number of tiers. And if you have a show that you really enjoy, such as Literary Treks or anything else, you can be an associate producer like I am, as well as Greg Rosier is for Literary Treks. And lastly, please leave us a star rating and a written review wherever you get your podcasts. It's great for us, and it helps others find the show because algorithms. Well, Jonathan, I think you've got some amazing news for us that I just found out myself.
Yeah, sometimes the Star Trek books, they break, sometimes really randomly. And this one broke and we kind of didn't know about it. And that is, there's a new Star Trek novel by Una McCormick coming. And what does Una write best? Una writes Deep Space Nine the best.
So
we're getting a new Deep Space Nine novel titled The Peacemakers, which is coming August 4th, 2026. Now, I know the answer to this, but I'm curious if you know this, Casey. Do you know when was the last time that we got a dedicated Deep Space Nine novel? Not a novel featuring the station, and not a novel featuring the characters, but the last time we got a dedicated Deep Space Nine book.
Yeah, was that in... It was Revenant by...
Alex White.
Alex White. I was going to say that, but that didn't sound right. But yes, by Alex White. I want to say like 2022, 2021 maybe?
2021, December 2021. It came out right after the Coda trilogy. And it was very much a much needed, calm, all right, it's a standalone DS9 book. But this is the first one in like what, 5 years that we've gotten. So I'm excited for that. It's Una, which is great. And you better believe there's got to be some Garrick in this book. If there's not, I don't know. It's Una's the imposter in this case.
And I don't want to say she's fired if Garrick's not in there. No. Because we want more books from her. But yes, it's got to have Garrick. It's got to. Well,
That's her shibboleth.
Yeah. What?
In the Bible, there was like they had to pronounce a word right for people to know, oh, he's really one of the group. So the word was shibboleth. That's her shibboleth is Garrick.
Okay. That's my one thing I've learned today then. So here is the blurb from the Simon & Schuster website for The Peacemakers by Una McCormick. It's 5 years since the end of the Dominion War. Jake Sisko is back on Earth after a long journey around the Gamma Quadrant, finishing up his book about what life is like out there after the collapse of the Dominion. It looks like Jake has a great life, travel, success, and a writing career that's going from strength to strength. The only problem is, everyone wants a piece of Jake Sisko. Whether it's Starfleet intelligence, full of questions about his trip through the wormhole, or the Bajoran people, anxious to be close to the son of their departed emissary, Jake is struggling to carve out space for himself. Then there are the rumors Jake heard out in the Gamma Quadrant. Rumors about Starfleet and his father and their conduct during the war. Rumors which, if they turned out to be true, would rock the very foundations of Jake Sisko's world. Jake accepts an invitation to an arts festival on Cardassia Prime, hoping to get some distance between himself and his worries. But even here, the past won't leave him alone. Starfleet intelligence are still interested, and there are people on Cardassia too for whom Jake Sisko seems to offer unique opportunities to advance their agendas. Jake flees into the Cardassian desert, joining a tour of ancient archaeological sites. And then, when the party is isolated from the rest of the world, the murders begin.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yes. He's on Cardassia, so Garrick's
gotta
be there.
So after the series, right?
Yep, 5 years after the series.
Which is just so interesting, because I don't expect it to be set during the post-Nemesis timeline. So we're not going to see version of the characters. But is it supposed to connect more to what we know with like where they're taking stuff with Picard?
I would assume so, because you know we've kind of wiped the slate clean with Coda. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this would be kind of a new post Deep Space Nine. I can't remember where Nemesis falls.
But from that, it's not going to be in that timeline of storytelling.
Oh, of the storytelling, no. But yeah, I would assume that it's somewhere. If it might be after Nemesis, you know, but before Picard, obviously. But
regardless, yeah, maybe, beggars can't be choosers. We're getting the Deep Space Nine book.
Yeah, I'm
okay,
stoked.
Okay, everybody, whatever you've been doing, do that for Voyager now. Come on, let's get it. Come on, Voyager.
We haven't had a Next Generation book in a while either, but...
No, we had one last year.
Did we?
Yeah, with Dayton Ward. Remember, that was the...
Where was I? Oh, yeah, the kind of DS9 crossover.
The DS9 crossover one, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, that was a really good one, too. What am I thinking? But yes, okay, let's get some Voyager. Kirsten, if you're listening, we could use you.
Hey, Christy Golden's
is she available?
Freelancing again, so...
Yeah, okay, well, yeah. Maybe they could do a collaboration.
Oh, please, please, please.
All right, well, we don't have a cover to judge yet. Probably won't get that for quite a while, but we're stoked. And so if you... It looks like there's links on the Simon & Schuster website, so you should be able to find it on Amazon. Please pre-order it. Let them know we want more of these books. That's how publishers know that there's interest in what they're putting out there, is by the pre-orders. Like, the sales are great, you know, after the book has come out, but I've heard from authors that the pre-orders are where the stats are at. Mm-hmm. So I will be pre-ordering the audiobook as soon as it becomes available.
Yep.
So we'll look forward to getting more information about that, and talk to Una hopefully once she's ready to talk about it. In the meantime, though, we got a few comic books. You know, we're trying to catch up on some comics here, and we've got some Lower Decks, which it's been a while since we've been in the world of Lower Decks. and we've got four issues, which is actually basically like
two arcs,
yeah, which I actually appreciated, rather than having, you know, one big long story arc or, you know, four issue arc.
Oh, see, like, at this point, now we're close enough, I was almost like, can we just make it one long issue? Like, at that point, why split it into two?
Yeah,
it's for the length of the comics, and I get it, but still, I'm like, it could be one.
Yeah, and these ones were, they're lower decks. Yeah, you know, what's interesting, too, is that the first two, which were, and I don't actually remember the names of them, but that's okay, The first two are really like their time travel shenanigans, it was kind of funny because they end up on the Titanic by the end of the first issue, and none
of them have prehistoric dinosaurs in the second one.
And then there's the dinosaurs in the second one. It's funny to me that they didn't know about the Titanic. Like by that point in the future, like that's just so far in the history that they don't even study the Titanic.
I love that there's even a joke where someone says, isn't that the ship that was sunk during World War One? And they're like, no, that's the Britannica or the Lusitania. And I was like, hey, I like the references there. The cover for the second issue showed dinosaurs on the Titanic. And I was like, okay, we'll see what you're doing here. And then they leave the Titanic almost instantly at the beginning of the second issue, and they're barely there with the dinosaurs at the end.
Yeah.
And I was like...
bait and switch.
I was like, look, I was with... I mean, it's ridiculous, but I was with you. Dinosaurs on the Titanic. I was spot in with that cover.
Yeah. And the story itself was, I mean, it was cute. It was fine, like the rest of the Lower Decks things. You know, it's just their Lower Decker shenanigans, you know, and interrupting the Upper Deckers and ending up saving the day anyway, like they always do.
Mm-hmm.
But
hiding under tablecloths.
I mean, you know, they can get away with so much on Lower Decks. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But the second... duology, if you want to call it that. The second arc was like, it was a kind of a riff on Yesterday's Enterprise. The title was, I can't remember. Yesterday's Beta Shift, I think is what it was called.
They had the ship in that flashback was the same class, I think, as the Enterprise C, because it looked just like the Enterprise C, which is probably why they wanted to go for that Yesterday's Enterprise reference.
That worked. And I mean, it was just like kind of flashbacks of Captain Freeman thinking about her time as a Lower Decker, which that one was actually, I think, a little bit more fun to see her kind of acting a lot like Mariner in some ways, and, you know, and just, yeah.
That one was funny. That one, I was laughing at all the Pulaski jokes. Oh, my word. When they're theorizing about why Pulaski kicked off the Enterprise.
Yeah.
Oh, that when they said, "Oh yeah, she's she stuffed Beverly in a compartment or something." I was, "Oh my goodness, that was a time I was like, look, that is you can't get away with that in like a canon book, like an actual like official thing, but you can get away with it in Lower Decks, and that was great."
Yes. Which I think Pulaski was in that Pliable Truths book by Dayton Ward, wasn't she? Didn't she show up on Deep Space Nine?
Yeah, briefly.
Yeah, it's come full circle there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that these two issues were probably the strongest. It was issues 7 and 8 of this current run of Lower Decks, and it was definitely the strongest. I liked that they're actually this time were not the little sub captions. I don't know what you call it, like at the bottom of each page where they try to make like an additional joke.
I did notice that those weren't there in the issue 7 and 8. I wonder if that was something that they got feedback on or that's just wasn't there.
Which I think the very, like in the first run of Lower Decks, which I think was only 8 or 10 issues maybe, or maybe not even that many, they did that on a handful of pages, like here and there, just to really drive a joke home you know, do something kind of funny. I think they've taken a little too far in episodes. Every time with these comic books, they're issues, not episodes. But with the issues 1 through 6, like it was every single page, it seemed like just about had something, and it was just like we're talking like 30 page comics here, so it's not like it's that much more to read, but most of them just didn't really land.
It's not about more to read, it's about the cutting the momentum of the of your experience reading it is when a character makes a dialogue joke, it because it's in universe, it feels like the flow of the story is going. But when you have to, it's like a footnote in a novel, in a book. When you're reading a book, the part of the reason that a lot of books use endnotes now instead of footnotes is because they would break your. That's why MLA is so annoying is because it's right there in the text, and then some have it in the footnotes, which is still there on the page, but the end notes are in the back, so it's, oh, you want to go see that, it's there, but it doesn't break your immersion, and that's what that those jokes were doing. So if they were in-universe, I think they would have worked a lot better.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, that makes total sense, because in issues 7 and 8, those were noticeably easier to get through, and like you said, it was the jokes were funnier, they hit better, and the story was just more cohesive, I think, too. It's just a start to finish kind of thing, even with I like how as Freeman's starting to drift off into her memories, Mariner even kind of calls her, she's like, you're not gonna jump into a flashback, are you now? And things like that. It was just really funny, and even how they kind of connected it almost like they do on a TV show where somebody's in this kind of dream state and then they start hearing their name and it's actually somebody in the real world kind of trying to get their attention or whatever, and they did that a couple times too. So it was fun. It was something that like actually would have been neat to see on the Lower Decks show, you know, seeing our upper deckers as lower deckers or something. But so it's kind of fun that they got to do that here in the comics, at least with the captain.
It was also cool that we got references to that Strange New Worlds episode that the Lower Decks crew was in, because they were like, oh yeah, and I was I tried to steal a shuttlecraft, and oh yeah, and I got to talk to Captain Pike, and I was like, I see the connections you're making there.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I kind of forgot about that part, but that was good. Yeah. That was, it was just, and that was in the first two issues,
right?
Yeah,
that was in the first two,
Because they had to go back to that planet, but, so yeah, it was nice that they were kind of making some connections there. These four issues were definitely stronger, I think, than the first four issues, which, to be honest, I don't really remember much of, but,
because
it was
neither.
Months ago.
Yeah.
But, I think, since these ones have come out, I think there's another three or four already out, so we'll get those in a few months. We've got some other comics to catch up on the next time. Like, I think we're going to do the Red Shirts. I think there's like four or five issues of that are all out, so we'll talk about those.
Yeah.
And then we've got like a Strange New Worlds arc. We've got the Voyager Homecoming arc that's currently running. I think there's two or three issues out right now, and I think that's going to be four or five issues, so so that'll be fun. And then also the ongoing The Last Starship, which is two episodes. God, I cannot stop calling these episodes. They're like little episodes.
It was Star Trek. We're supposed to say episodes.
We're supposed to say episodes, but yes, there's two issues of The Last Starship out, so that'll be interesting to get into once there's a few more out, and get to see Kirk and the original Enterprise in the Star Trek Discovery future timeline. So, but we'll get to those later. But first, how about we go check on which version of Greg Cox we're gonna talk to? Well, it is a pleasure once again to be joining with us today with Greg Cox, and he is quite a prolific author, I guess, in the Star Trek world. And his latest book, what we're going to be talking about, is the original series book, Identity Theft, which just recently came out. And Greg, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me again.
Yes, it's always a pleasure, and I'm glad to. Glad you guys are so open, all the authors, to come and talk to little old podcasts like us to talk about your books, because we enjoy it so much.
As I was just saying off camera, we sit and write these books in silence, and then we wait for them to creep through the publication process for months. And so it's great for us to finally have a chance to put them out in the world and talk to people and hear what people think of them.
Yeah. Well, I guess, kind of like what we want to, like, as we always start these conversations, I guess, like, can you just talk a little bit about how the book came about? Like, what was the the genesis. We get a lot of books these days in the Strange New Worlds, or, you know, I think we've even got a Picard novel coming out soon. But, you know, these rare treats of original series novels, you know, don't come around too terribly often. So, you know, how'd that come across your plate?
Well, I honestly, my last several novels have all been TOS. I guess I'm the TOS, one of the TOS guys these days, not claiming it's my exclusive turf. But, you know, and I watch all the other shows religiously. I enjoy them. I will be there, you know, when Starfleet Academy drops that day. But TOS, the original series, is Star Trek I grew up on that played in the background of my entire childhood and adolescence, you know. So, you know, that's my first love, and that's, you know, my Star Trek, as it were. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily the best, or I'm not going to argue which one is the best, but it's my Star Trek, so I'm always very comfortable doing. And at this point, I have been writing Star Trek for a long time, not to keep belaboring the point, I'm old, but, you know, I'm like 30 plus years now, so I'm always on the search for what haven't I done yet, just to personally challenge myself and to keep myself interested and to not repeat myself. And, okay, this book is the Chekhov book. That, I mean, honestly, it's titled Identity Theft, but I always just refer to it as the Chekhov book, because this is very much a book about Chekhov. He is the main character. He is the protagonist. Not too spoilerly, he saves the world. He gets the girl. Kirk, Spock, McCoy, Sulu, Uhura, they're all in the book. Don't get me wrong, but they are supporting characters. And one of the reasons I did this, I realized I had never really done much of Chekhov. Again, he was in the books, of course, and I'd like to think I gave him a good line, a good scene here and there, but I'd never really done anything with Chekhov. I felt I neglected him. And indeed, looking around, honestly, there didn't seem to be a whole lot of Chekhov-centric Trek novels. So, okay, well, that was sort of, you know, new territory. So job one, the first idea was, okay, I'm going to give Chekhov his moment in the sun. He is entitled to it. I haven't done anything with him, so I went back and binge-watched all the Chekhov-ish moments and episodes, and that was the genesis of the book. Okay, let's come up with a plot that, and without getting too much into the plot, which we will, Chekhov ends up getting cut off from his support system, from the ship, from the Enterprise, from his usual resources. And part of the reason for that, I always sort of started with the idea, if Chekhov is going to be the spotlight character, and he is very much the protagonist, well, then I kind of have to cut him off, because otherwise he's playing a subordinate role. And invariably, Kirk and Spock, and he's going to be, you know, I, sir, do this. So to give Chekhov his hero moment, I had to basically cut out his support system and get him out there on his own. So, he's forced to rely on his own wits and resources and creativity without being necessarily the fourth ranked guy on the landing party, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was it. The new goal was, I'm going to write the Chekhov book. And it is, if you like Chekhov, this is the book. Okay, so.
And unfortunately for Chekhov, even in his own book, he still can't get like the front and center, you know, on the cover. He's still always, like in the show, he's always still regulated to the third
slot. This is my concession to reality. Yes, a fully accurate cover would have Chekhov front and center. I am practical enough to realize that for marketing purposes, my goal was, as long as Chekhov was on the cover and he was wearing the right uniform, I want this book to sell as well. Okay. You know?
Right. Yeah. Were there any discussions about putting the aliens from this book on the cover? That would have been an interesting choice.
There wasn't, you know, basically the main issue I had and I heard was that, you know, please put Chekhov on the cover. And also, 99% of the book, the very first chapter takes place during the original 5-year mission. But 99% of the book is, you know, set during the movie era, i.e. the maroon uniforms and all that. So I do remember dropping a note to my editor and saying, just to be clear, we need the maroon uniforms on the cover, you know, because this is 99% a movie era novel. This is... Also Chekhov needs to look, you know, movie age. He's not the mean young ensign. He's the somewhat older, a bit more battered by Starfleet life, 40 plus year old Chekhov. And that was my one request. Could we please get, you know, the movie era characters on the cover, and please let's get Chekhov there. Because if Chekhov, again, no one fought me on this. They sent me the cover. Oh, thank God, Chekhov is there. That was pretty much the end of the discussion, you know. I remember thinking, this is very much the Chekhov book. So, and yes, is Kirk bigger on the cover? Of course, because he's the star. It's a Star Trek novel. And to be clear, Kirk is in the novel, and Kirk is, you know, has some good heroic moments as well. But, you know, in the interest of truth in advertising, Chekhov needs to be on the cover. Okay, you know.
Yeah.
And in the interest of marketing, you know, Kirk needs to be on the cover. You know?
Right.
I was hoping for a Freaky Friday style cover where you have the alien on one side and you have Chekhov on the other, mm-hmm. and the alien's in the Starfleet uniform and Chekhov's like not wearing much.
Yeah, that would be a very literal and I'm not sure. Like I said, I was not privy. Like I said, the cover department is you know above my pay grade.
Yeah,
but I will say they always run it by me, and I always have input. And occasionally, I'll go, "Well, hi, you know, McCoy isn't in that scene. Oh, okay, or whatever." You know, but.
Yeah, there were quite a few new aliens, like the Voyager, obviously. But I mean, I feel like even some of the crew or the people, you know, in the various settings throughout the book. I mean, you had to really got to kind of go to town on creating a bunch of different looks and everything. Did you kind of sketch any of these out, or is it just kind of, you know, free association, just like I want to see this or I want to see that?
Lots of thinking about it and scribbling on legal pads. But one of the ideas was in the book, they're kind of way out on the fringes here, out on the final frontier. We aren't not deeply within, you know, the borders of the Federation. We're out sort of off the beaten track a bit, which is, again, this all this you start with him and things start to fall. Okay, well, Chekhov's on his own. He can't just wander into the nearest Starfleet embassy, you know, or local Star Trek, you know, large Starfleet spaceport or, you know, whatever base. So, okay, it has to be way out there where there's very little of a Starfleet presence. And from there, it then follows that I can't really go overboard with, you know, familiar faces and Tellarites and Andorians and Vulcans, mm-hmm. because Chekhov is out on his own in strange, unfamiliar territory, which meant coming up with strange, unfamiliar aliens, which meant having to come up with at least two different worlds, and plus PlayStation and various guest characters and an independent space cruiser. So, yeah. But again, it's funny, you start with a basic core idea. Okay, I want to book about Chekhov. Well, okay, if Chekhov is going to shine, I need to get him off the bridge. I need to get him out of the rank structure, you know. Oh, well, in that case, if Chekhov's on his own, we have to be way out on the final frontier, and he can't just, you know, drop by the nearest, you know, Starfleet base or, you know, Federation embassy or whatever. So, okay, so we're in unfamiliar territory off the beaten track, and there are issues of jurisdiction and prime directive and what exactly mm-hmm. can be done. But again, it all sort of follows logically to how do I put Chekhov in deep, bad situation so we can see him, you know, rise to the occasion. Hence all the unfamiliar aliens, which I had a lot of fun with just trying to come up with. Again, you know, because this is a body swap book, because this is Freaky Friday.
Yeah.
And I actually saw a review the other day on what we used to call Twitter that, you know, described it as Freaky Friday meets the Undiscovered Country, which I love.
That was my review.
I probably took a screen grab of it, sent to my editor. If we're going to do a body swap, and yes, Chekhov ends up swapping bodies with a alien with nefarious purposes, I decided, okay, we got to have fun with this. It's no point of him just being into another humanoid who's just maybe like, you know, normal humanoid with some bumps on their forehead, you know. Mm. No, let's he's switching bodies to an alien. I need another alien, but not so weird that he's a weird silicon-based crystalline, you know, butterfly or something. But okay, so like I said, I came up with the idea that, okay, what if these are humanoids? They're humanoids. That's what I wanted him running, jumping. And, but okay, they aren't descended from primates. They're descended from cervines, you know, moose, elk, deer, et cetera. So, right, he's a humanoid deer. And he has a snout and he has antlers. Poor Chekhov wakes up and he has a snout and antlers. And it was I'll be honest, that was not in my outline.
Oh.
my original 12-page outline that was approved by CBS, or just said he could slip through the body of it. And I do admit, right up to the minute I submitted the book, I was like, okay, is this too weird? Is this too dopey that, you know, Chekhov becomes an alien deer? You know? I even write a scene where he, early on, where he's trying to go through a doorway and his antlers stuck. And I'm like, okay, am I getting too goofy here? But honestly, I got no pushback on this.
Wow.
You know, CBS, Simon & Schuster, they were fine. But again, the whole idea is I'm going to do a body swap. I want him to find Chekhov. Basically, how much can I torture Chekhov in this book?
Yeah.
Because that's what Chekhov is for, to be tortured.
Yep.
But it's got to be a little weird and disorienting. So if he suddenly finds himself a humanoid deer, that's weird.
Yeah.
So that was where that idea came from. And I remember playing around, okay, it has to be some sort of weird alien. How weird can I get without being too weird? You know, I didn't want to do the gender swap thing because Turnabout Intruder had already done that, and I didn't want to go down that road.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're going to switch, if he's going to create bodies of an alien, it has to be kind of alien, because what's the point? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I liked the kind of deer aspect to it because like for Chekhov, I mean, being in a body swap situation, it's just going to be awkward for anybody anyway. But then to have a body that's so different, and you know, even when he and we're gonna get super into spoilers here, but when he escapes the kind of hospital that he's in, and he's just in his hospital gown and then goes naked. I mean, he doesn't feel any shame for that because it's not his body. He doesn't know what he should, you know, like on our humans, like we know where our quote unquote shameful parts are, you know, but so he just goes out and has fun with it. But even the antlers and when Raijo is, I think he has to put a environmental suit on at some point, and he kind of hesitates for a second because he's like, how am I going to get this over my antlers? Oh, I don't have antlers in this body.
Right. Raijo being, of course, the deer person who is who is running around in Chekhov's body for most of the book, and who's honestly kind of the co-protagonist.
Right.
We have two plot lines, because we're getting heavy into spoilers here.
Yeah.
That we have Chekhov stuck in the deer's body, running around trying to, you know, get back to the Enterprise to warn them there's an imposter aboard the ship. And we have to also have the imposter in kind of the pressure cooker situation of having to pretend to be Chekhov, which turns out to be much trickier and harder than he expected, especially when the Enterprise finds itself dealing with a very intense, life-threatening emergency situation.
Mm-hmm.
But Raijo finds out that being Chekhov is much harder than he expected. And the bit with also the fact that he's got his sort of phantom. He has his phantom antlers that he keeps wanting to scratch all through the book. Whenever he gets nervous, he wants to reach up and scratch his non-existent, which is, again, not something in my original outline, which is a sort of, as I was writing the book and discovering the character, that would be kind of give him a mannerism that he had, like, you know, you hear about phantom limbs and things.
Yeah.
That he's got he keeps wanting to scratch his antlers and they aren't there, you know. The other reason for doing the deer, I remember, it's coming back to me now, is just also what it hasn't been done in Star Trek. We've had a fair number of feline aliens and cat people, and we've seen, you know, other kinds of aliens and reptile people and lizard people. And, you know, I don't think we've seen humanoid deer people. Okay, well, maybe there's reasons for that, you know, but again, I have no makeup budget. So, okay, that's kind of weird and cool and different, I thought, and it's one of the things where, you know, kind of like, you know, Spinal Tap, there was the line about, you know, just fine line between genius and stupidity. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to make them deer people. Yeah, we will see if this flies. Okay. It may be brilliant. I don't know. But it was weird and different. And I had a lot of fun with it, obviously.
Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier about, you know, incorporating the kind of the romance, which also becomes kind of a thwarted romance in the book. And I was interested because we know from the Picard series that Chekhov has at least a son, but we don't necessarily know from that who his mother is. And so I spent the reading of the book is Chekhov going to end up with this nurse, or is he not? And you kept me guessing the whole time, and I liked that. Was that a factor when you were considering the romance, or were you just trying to write it within this and it just...
Yeah, no, I wasn't thinking ahead. I admit the idea that Simone might actually be, you know, the mother of Chekhov's child way down the road in Picard continuity did not occur to me. And honestly, I have to give credit here to my editor, Margaret Clark. It was Margaret's idea to give Chekhov a love interest aboard the Enterprise, because in order to increase the complicate Raijo's life, because again, Raijo is trying to blend in, who's the fake Chekhov, is trying to blend in and poses the real Chekhov. And the biggest part of his challenge, he discovers, is not sitting on the bridge and going, aye, aye, sir, yes, captain, you know, navigating coordinates, you know, raising shields. It's having to socialize and interact with Sulu and Yura and all these people who have known Chekhov for years. And it was Margaret who thought, you know, if we really want to make things complicated, it may be that what if Chekhov has got some sort of romance going on, you know, with somebody aboard the Enterprise, and that would just, you know, that maybe, as in the book, Raijo doesn't know about because we decided it was a relatively new thing in its early days, so he hasn't been briefed on this. And that would sort of, you know, complicate things. So yeah, if you like the plot line with Simone, I always tell everybody that was Margaret Clark's idea, that you should give him a love interest in the Enterprise just to make life altogether more complicated, you know. So, yeah. Now, we flirted briefly with bringing back, because this is a Chekhov book, his old girlfriend, Irina, the space hippie. But we eventually decided it was easier just to invent a new character who didn't have all that space hippie baggage.
We appreciate that more, too, probably.
So. I didn't want to bring back the space hippies. Okay, no. You know, yeah. And also, I did some research and discovered that some of my fellow Star Trek authors have already done stuff with Irina. Mm. So, okay, that loose end has been tied up already. I invented my own character, who's a newly assigned nurse aboard the Enterprise. So,
yeah. Well, I think that was definitely added. The more tension, and it's just kind of interesting, like with you know, the character of Raijo, who's impersonating Chekhov. He's in Chekhov's body, but he has to impersonate him. And he's got the voice. He's got a lot of knowledge, you know, from, you know, what they've been able to glean from the records. But he has to convince the crew, and especially like Sulu, once he realizes that Sulu is his, well, I guess he's already known from the intel that Sulu's his best friend. But he's got to convince them that he's the real Chekhov, which I think was an interesting, must have been an interesting challenge writing that, because we're seeing it from Raijo's point of view. So we know, as the reader know, and, you know, Raijo obviously knows that he's an imposter, but none of the crew can. So he's got to be just, you know, convincing enough, I guess, as Chekhov, that Kirk and Sulu and even Simone don't realize that it's Chekhov, even though we know, and Raijo even knows that he doesn't have all the information. I mean, like, that must have been a challenge just to get the impersonation, I guess, just right. You're writing Chekhov, but played by a different character.
And yeah, just trying to dial up the sort of, you know, the pressure on Raijo. And again, he realizes early on that the big challenge is not going to be sitting on the bridge. It's going to be off, you know, in his off hours hanging out with Sulu. And he realizes actually the Sulu is his biggest threat, because if anybody's going to realize I'm not the real Chekhov, it's going to be my buddy Sulu. But the problem he has, of course, is that he can't keep his distance from Sulu, or because that act too aloof and not take part in the social activities aboard the ship, because then that would be suspicious. So he had, and of course, the whole thing with Simone, which wasn't in his briefing. No, you know, he doesn't even know what the status of the relationship is, and you know, who is this woman and what is our, but he can't, and again, he can't just, you know, have nothing to do with her because that might be suspicious, you know? And he's like, wait, we had a date scheduled. I'm sorry. Cause you know, I decided early on was that the relationship had to be very, very in the early days. And you're still kind of, so, and poor Simone is cool. Like, you're running hot and cold here. I can't get a handle, you know, on you.
Yeah.
And even Sulu's occasionally like, well, what's with you, man? You're not acting like yourself. Oh, so, you know, so.
Yeah.
That was just all, like I said, sort of, you know, putting Raijo in the pressure cooker and dialing that up and just. Plus, it was great. One of the things I enjoyed about this book, you know, personally, was getting so much of it was getting to see the characters off the bridge. and hanging out. And that's, yeah, we've seen glimpses of that on the show, of them hanging out in the rec room, or you're doing a little impromptu jam session, you know, in the, you know, commissary or something. But a lot of times when you're writing a tense, you know, thriller, there's not time to show the characters just hanging out. But here, this was when I got to show the characters just hanging out, but they could be suspense scenes because I'm telling them from Rhino's point of view, and he's trying very hard not to to act like Chekhov, but not blow his cover. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, he's like going bowling and knows that Chekhov's a good bowler, but he's so nervous that he can't hit a pin.
That, like I admit, that was a little bit of a bucket item. I've been working to get the bowling alley, because, you know, the bowling alley is canon. It's mentioned on the show. You can see it on all the, you know, official printed blueprints of the Enterprise. I have been wanting to get the bowling alley into a book for years. But I didn't want to force it. A lot of the books went, oh my God, they're in the middle of a huge space battle with the Klingons. No, I'm not going to stop and do a chapter where they all go bowling. But, oh, okay, this was a case to, you know, oh, we got to see Chekhov in his off hours. He goes bowling with Sulu. And gee, Raja discovers that this weird human sport of bowling is trickier than he thought it was. You know? Yeah. And what do you mean we have a usual Wednesday night bowling game, you know, it's not in his record. So, but yeah, I got to show the rec room from, looking at my, Mr. Scott's Guide to the Enterprise diagrams and the swimming pool and the botanical gardens and the breakfast nooks. It was fun exploring different corners of the Enterprise that usually you're in the conference room, you're on the bridge, you're in sick bay, you know.
Yeah.
To show the social life aboard the Enterprise until everything goes to hell. And of course things get, frantic, but that was one of the fun things I enjoyed about the book. And I admit that bringing the bowling alley into the book, writing a scene in the bowling alley, has been on my sort of, to-do list for a long time. And this is the book where it actually makes sense to do it. Up until now, there's never been really a reason why I needed a bowling game in the middle of a Star Trek novel. but now it's suspense, because you have a spy and he's trying to learn how to bowl, and he sucks because he's an alien deer.
When you were talking about the, conceiving things for the book is just by its nature significantly more lighthearted and fun than maybe other Star Trek books, especially other Star Trek books that have been coming out recently. Was that a directive given to you by Simon and Schuster, or did you pitch that, or how did that come about? Because it's clearly distinctively different than the other ones we've been getting recently.
Honestly, that was not dictated to me. And honestly, that was not even really kind of intended. I mean, I always meant the book to be kind of a fast-paced, thrilling adventure with Chekhov. It actually ended up being, it's not a comedy, but it ended up being somewhat breezier and funnier than I intended it to be. And part of that is just Chekhov. If you go back and watch the original episodes, you go back and watch the original feature films, you'll find out that you notice very quickly that, okay, Chekhov's not literally comedy relief. But often his role is to make a wry little joke funny. Chekhov is, in the old show, he's the green young kid. And even in the movies, he's often, if you need a moment of levity, you cut to Chekhov and Chekhov makes. So just trying to be in Chekhov's head and write Chekhov and how would Chekhov react to these situations. Well, this is the guy who, complains because, McCoy keeps taking blood samples from him, and who jokes about, Chekhov, has the funny scene with the whale if he's interrogated with the FBI. And when he's, so Chekhov is kind of a funny character. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure he has deep depths and there's great stuff. And I get into some of his stuff and everything. But it is, I found just writing a book from Chekhov's point of view, and putting Chekhov in the situation. Chekhov is, brings levity, it's a funny guy. So I ended up sort of leaning into that. And I think we were sort of discovering, you start out with your 12-page outline, which is just, the plot. Mm-hmm. And I've got all the plot beats worked out. But as I'm writing, this book is turning out to be a bit breezier and funnier than I intended it to be. But okay, that's where the book is taking you. I can also confess that one of my models for this book, when I was thinking of a book, is that the word in my head was this. I was going for sort of a Hitchcockian thriller. And I ended up leaning into sort of the funnier Hitchcockian movies. This is, North by Northwest, 39 Steps, which are about usually some poor schmuck who finds himself in over his head, thrown into a web of intrigue and mystery and on his own and framed for a murder he didn't commit. If you're familiar with North by Northwest or the 39 Steps or, check out, Hitchcock's more breezier sort of Man on the Run adventures. Oh, well, those films have a certain sense of humor to them. We're not talking Psycho or The Birds here. I went back and rewatched The 39 Steps and North by Northwest and some, and The Lady Vanishes and some of Hitchcock's lighter sort of, adventure thriller storylines, and ended up, this is sort of the tone we're going for here.
And with the end of the book, the climax, it's almost kind of a Man Who Knew Too Much, where the assassination attempt.
That's another, again, Hitchcock kind of liked the formula of some ordinary guy who just finds himself thrown into the middle of, wrong place at the wrong time, middle of a whole sort of complicated espionage, assassin, thriller, fugitive plot line. And rising to the occasion and sort of surviving just on their sort of wits alone. And, Chekhov is Cary Grant. Chekhov is, we're throwing him into a Hitchcock plot with cool sci-fi stuff and in the body of an eight. And mistaken identities tend to be a hard, big part of these books, these old Hitchcock type thrillers. And I go, what's more of a mistaken identity plot than someone stealing your body and your identity? I didn't pitch this. To answer your question, no, Simon Schuster CBS didn't ask me for, can you give us a more lighthearted Star Trek adventure? And I didn't go into this thinking that, I went into this thinking I want to write about Chekhov and for reasons, and then ended up, mistaken identity, spy thriller plot, etc. And then just in the process of writing the book, this is turning out to be more of a breezier, less angsty book than I imagined,
Yeah. Well, it's just, got to be fast paced throughout it as the, Chekhov is racing to catch up to the Enterprise and, steals a yacht,
honestly,
there.
The book ended up being a little breezier and faster. My last Star Trek novel was 130,000 words. I think this one is about 93,000 words.
Okay.
But that wasn't deliberate. That wasn't dictated by anybody. That was just, this is more of a fast-paced plot, and it's a clock-ticking plot, so I didn't want it to drag. So it ended up being, a book finds its own area, what's the correct length, and, it's contractually they're supposed to be around a certain length.
Sure.
I went over my contracted limit on the last one. I came in a little under my contracted limit this time around. But again,
it evens out.
But honestly, no one complained, because as long as they're guidelines. The word counts in the contracts are guidelines.
Yeah.
As long as, here's 15,000 words. Oh, Greg, we wanted a novel, not a short story.
Sure.
Yeah, and honestly, I didn't get any pushback from Greg. This book is only 93,000 words long. It's a fast paced kind of breezy book. It ended up being, whereas the last book, Lost to Eternity, was very, three different story lines. It was a very big, ambitious book, and that ended up going way over my contracted. And again, never any complaints from the powers that be about the book being too short or too long, because the books are what they are. And some books need a lot of space to breathe in, and some books, like I said, I just, it's a spy thriller. I kept the pace going.
Yeah. Well, I like that, we kind of have our, the main story being the reason behind the story, just that the Enterprise back during its 5-year mission had kind of helped broker effectively a ceasefire on this planet, but in doing so inadvertently caused some of the population to be exiled from the planet. It wasn't so much an end to a civil war as just a parting of ways. And so when we catch up with Raijo's, you know, people, he's basically on an assassination plot. But since we get into his head, and since he gets to spend so much time with our Enterprise A crew, he starts to get, I guess, kind of have, I don't know, a come to Jesus moment, or kind of see the other side, I guess, or see that, like, the Starfleet isn't the evil organization that he thought it was that got him exiled, that, you know, maybe he's been wronged or his people have been wronged, but he starts seeing the Enterprise crew for who they are. In fact, even on a side quest, we get to see him as Chekhov save the shuttle crew. And it was hard but fun, you know, watching Raijo through this, because on the one hand, you know, he's one of the bad guys, but as you go through it, you're kind of almost rooting for him to not necessarily succeed in his quest, but to, you want to see how his story turns out and hope it turns out positively.
Well, exactly. The thing about Raijo, he's second generation. We're 20 years on from, mm-hmm. you know, Civil War that Kirk, you know, in his inimitable manner, kind of, you know, ended, you know. And he's grown up in the exile community being told that, you know, with, you know, Kirk in particular being demonized. He's the meddling Starfleet guy who came in and, you know, messed up everything, you know, brought about the dishonorable peace that caused our side to kind of, peace is not easily achieved. It's only 20 years. And it's been 20 years since Kirk brought peace to this world and ended this generation's long civil war, which is a good thing. But, you know, the Civil War is still in living memory. And, you know, there are people who are not happy with how it turned out. And poor Raijo has spent his whole life hearing about the great and glorious victory that Kirk deprived him and of the life he put, and his family and their circumstances have declined. They're living in exile. So, you know, he goes into this, you know, the Federation is, he's, ever since he was, you know, a child on his father's knees, he's heard about, you know, the damn interfering Starfleet, Kirk, the meddling devil who ruined everything and, you know, are responsible for, you know, completely wrecking, you know, our planet, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but then, as you said, he starts out, you know, hating Starfleet because that's all he's ever heard growing up. And then as he has to sort of interact and be Chekhov and, oh, gee, you know, they seem like nice people. Oh, geez, you know, Captain Kirk seems to be a pretty good captain, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe he has to keep reminding himself, and this is not too spoilerly, no, these are not my friends. These are Chekhov's friends, you know. I have to pretend they're my friends. And yeah, oh, and, you know, no, yeah. These are the enemies of my people. Don't forget that, even though, okay, it looks like, okay, Kirk looks like he's a pretty good captain for his people. I can see why they're all so loyal to him. But he still screwed over my people 20 years ago, you know. So, you know, it messes with his head. And I had a lot of time, you know. Again, the idea was him being a pressure cooker here and getting into his motives and him sort of coming to appreciate maybe having his assumptions about Starfleet shattered as he has to, in fact, rise to the occasion and be Chekhov in perilous circumstances. He suddenly finds, in a way, landing party's life depending on him, you know, and it's up to me to save these people who are the enemy of my people, but I have to. They're looking for me to save them.
Right.
And meanwhile, Chekhov obviously has a grudge against Raijo. Raijo is the bastard who stole his body and is obviously up to no good on the Enterprise. But he ends up having to walk a mile in Raijo's hooves, as it were. And he learns more about Raijo and his background. And he finds himself having to, by the end of the book, not like, oh, well, I'm going to let Raijo assassinate people because I understand where he's coming from now. No, but and he finds himself, unfortunately, again, just as Raijo is having to deal with, you know, his friends aboard the Enterprise, unfortunately, poor Chekhov has to deal with the stuff of Raijo's life. And he didn't even get a briefing. So he's like, oh, you know, Raijo has burned bridges. He has enemies. He has a somewhat bitter ex-girlfriend. all of which gets, poor Chekhov has scenes where literally people show up and want to beat him up, and he doesn't know why. You have your nerve showing your face here around here. What?
And you think she's off the beaten path too.
And he has no idea. He gradually starts to get her pieces of Raja's life and understands what's going on. But yeah, he's, keeps getting mistaken for Raja. And indeed, at times he has to pretend to be Raja for plot reasons. He goes, obviously, no, I'm really Chekhov. And, I'm a Starfleet officer. And no one believes him. He checked at the Enterprise and, our records indicate the Enterprise left 3 days ago and Commander Chekhov was aboard. And it turns out that Raja has a criminal record a mile long, so he's not the most trustworthy character. But yeah, it's sort of having fun with both of them. Yes, as Raja is trying to, cope with, Chekhov's life. Who the hell is this Simone person anyway?
Mm-hmm.
Chekhov is having to, deal with the complications of Raijo's life and, relationships and his estranged relationship with his father and, and they end up having to understand each other much better than either of them would like.
Yeah.
it was something I sort of discovered writing the book, that it ended up, Raijo, who in the book, in the outline, was just sort of the antagonist, ended up being more, I don't want to say sympathetic, but we get to really kind of understand him and getting in his head, since about half the book is from his head.
Yeah.
Jumping back and forth between Chekhov as, from Raijo as Chekhov and Chekhov as Raijo.
Yeah.
I actually got an email one day from the audiobook people asking me, so how are we supposed to handle this and the voices and the act? Distinguish between, Raijo as Chekhov and Chekhov as Raijo? Does he have different voices? And actually, I admit, that had never occurred to me. I'd have passed the bucket and said, you're the audio people. Use your business. I trust you. Poor Robert Petkoff. I kind of threw a challenge at him there,
Yeah.
it would make sense to me to make any internal dialogue be the actual person. And then if they say anything out loud in dialogue, make it the voice of whoever they're impersonating.
That sounds logical, but it seems to me that could be very confusing for the reader if,
we
did talk about it. I went, obviously when Raijo is Chekhov and he has dialogue, he has to sound like Chekhov because he's fooling everybody aboard the ship, But then having jumping back and forth for his dialogue and having a different voice for his internal narrative, and then having Chekhov have a different voice, when he's Raijo, but having his internal narrative in the accent. Oh God, like I said, I my apologies to Robert Petkoff, who is the reader who reads the book. I hope he found this a fun and fascinating challenge, and he wasn't, what the hell did you do to me, Greg?
Well, I actually listened to the audiobook as I read it.
Oh.
It was pretty interesting. And he did do that, like Jonathan, as you said, it was like internal, thoughts were in their own accents. But I think the book was written well enough that I would hope that anybody who's listening to it, without the text in front of them, it felt clear to me that when Raijo is speaking as Chekhov, it's always Raijo said, or it wasn't ever written like, we're trying to trick the reader into thinking this is Chekhov. So
unfortunately they are separated for most of the book. There's never a scene where both of them are in the same scene until like maybe very near the end of the book, So just by context, if you're stranded on this planet, running around being chased by the cops, well, that's Chekhov as Raijo. If you're on the Enterprise and you're on a rescue mission, well, that's Raijo as Chekhov. But
I'm suddenly realizing that all they needed to do was just say, hey, Chekhov, can you check on the nuclear vessels? And just get him to say vessels and be like, no, that's not Chekhov.
Yeah.
That's it.
I've only listened to the first 10 minutes of the audiobook, I confess. I've just been, so.
Yeah. Alan Robert Petkoff always does such a good job with those. So,
oh God, his George Takei voice.
Oh my gosh, yes.
If I didn't know better, I'd say that was he's got Sulu's intonation so well. And Sulu also ended up being a much bigger, again, you discover the books as you write them. Sulu ended up being a much bigger part of the book than I realized, because of course, once you start getting into Chekhov's personal life and Sulu as his best friend, Well, then suddenly again, you suddenly realize that Sulu has to be there. And it's like, it all kind of follows logically. I have an outline, but when the hazardous rescue, search and rescue mission. Well, of course, Sulu has to be there because Chekhov and Sulu, their interactions, or rather, Sulu with Raijo as Chekhov is a fraught situation. So Sulu has to be on that rescue mission too. And of course, Nurse Simone has to be on that mission because that just makes dials up the tension too. So it just sort of follows from there. But yeah, I ended up doing a lot more Sulu, and I'm glad that Sulu is on the cover.
Yeah.
Because if you're writing a book about Chekhov and Chekhov's life and Chekhov's, you know, social life, how do you not have Sulu there all the time? And this sort of actually dictated as I'm writing scenes. Okay, Sulu has to have a bigger part here, and Sulu has to be on the, you know, away mission, and Sulu has to be in this scene, and we need another scene with Sulu, you know. So
yeah, and I liked it. I mean, with as much as we all understand that Chekhov and Sulu are best friends, I feel like because they're both somewhat minor characters, you know, because we got the Kirk, Spock, McCoy as the main characters of Star Trek, we've always known that Sulu and Chekhov are like best friends. We even see it in Star Trek V when they're vacationing together. But, you know, it's really nice, especially, you know, like the bowling scene, but even just how Sulu reacted after Chekhov saved their lives, you know, after the shuttle crashed. And also I like too that Chekhov was actually in command of that mission too. So he's kind of like asking Sulu, well, what would you do in this situation? But getting to see them play off of each other as much as we did, it was nice just because we don't get to see that as often as we probably should.
Well, you know, that's also just part of the function also of 1960s television, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes modern, I find viewers forget that, you know, TOS was not a modern day ensemble show where all the crew are listed in the opening credits. You go back and look at the opening credits for TOS, it's Shatner, Nimoy, and, you know, eventually, like in the second season, DeForest Kelly. Everybody else is in the closing credits at the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why didn't they use you? Well, that was simply not the nature of 1960s television.
Yeah.
Now you get to Next Gen, or you watch Discovery, the Martian Show, and the whole cast, everybody gets their name up in lights at the beginning. Mm-hmm. People are wondering, well, why didn't they do more? It wasn't an ensemble show. There were the stars and there were the backup characters. And just go back and look at the opening credits. I mean, even McCoy didn't get his name into the opening credits. You know, DeForest Kelly didn't get his name into the opening credits until, I think, the second season, you know, when they realized that the whole Kirk Spock McCoy trio was working. So, yeah, that was fun to actually, you know, again, that was sort of like, you know, indeed, I've written lots and lots of TOS novels, and I can't say I've done a whole lot of Chekhov. And that was like, finally, okay, I'm going to do a book focused on Chekhov.
Yeah. One thing that you briefly mentioned earlier, but this is really a kind of a follow-on, and I, in my notes here, called it a redemption of Turnabout Intruder, which is not one of the most loved episodes of the original series, especially as the last episode. But I guess it was kind of a natural follow-on when you're going to do an identity theft or body switching story, given that that was kind of the one from the show. But how does it feel to have redeemed that episode and made it better, I guess?
It's funny you should say that. And I mean, on my list of to-do list was, I do have a Star Trek to-do list. The body swap technology from Turnabout Intruder has been sort of on my list of things to get to, if it's kind of a loose end.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that lends itself to a spy espionage plot. It's been on my to-do list for a while, but I will, this is a true story. When I first pitched this book to Margaret Clark and I sent in the outline to the powers to be, the first thing I said, like, I swear, like first sentence, the outline was, this is not a sequel to Turnabout Intruder. It should not be pitched as a, you know, this, I am lifting a plot device from, but this is a completely different story. I was actually pretty emphatic about it. I'm not like coming to them with, hey, I want to do a sequel to Turnabout Intruder. No, I think, you know, warning, this is not a sequel to Turnabout Intruder. I'm just picking up on a plot device, you know. And I have seen a few reviews. The book has just came out, so the reviews are just starting to creep in. And generally, I'm happy to see it's getting a positive response. So there are a few people like, Turnabout Intruder? What in God's name are you going back to Turnabout Intruder? I mean, I was worried about that. Like I said, I kind of I was preemptive. I was defensive. I kind of, like I said, I don't. At the very beginning of my outline, because typically for those who don't know, these projects begin with me writing like a 12-page outline to send to Pocketbooks and to CBS for their approval and input. Warning, just to be clear, because I started out with, hi, I want to do a sequel to Turn About Intruder. That wasn't going to apply. As you say, not universally loved. Yeah. So you say, look, you know, this should not be perceived, marketed, or pitched as Turnabout Intruder, this is part two. This is, I'm just lifting the body swap technology for the purposes of an entirely different story.
Yeah.
Of course, the book is not called Turnabout Intruder or Turnabout Redux or anything like that.
Yeah. I think there was a brief mention of the turnabout technology or something like that towards the end.
I'm bringing it in. People do refer to. I always work on the assumption that not every reader has memorized every single episode. There are references to the notorious Kirk Janis Lester incident, 2268 or whatever it was, and people we find about how the technology, we saw in that episode fell into the wrong hands, despite Starfleet's best effort. So, I briefly recap the event. And indeed, I went back and watched Turnabout Intruder. I pay my dues.
Yeah.
And made sure that how I portrayed it was consistent and actually got some good ideas. One of the things I discovered watching Turnabout Intruder again, which again is not an episode I often revisit, was that the turnabout effect does tend to wear off, but not right away. Near the end of the episode, their minds are starting to switch back and forth randomly. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, well, that's great. I can have a lot of fun with that. And as the plot accelerates and as the turnabout effect starts to wear off, there are moments increasingly, microscopic at first, but where, Chekhov briefly finds himself back in his own body. Rilo briefly finds himself back, and then they flash back, and then they flash back, and then again, this is dial up the pressure because Rilo realizes that the turnabout thing is wearing off, and he's under kind of a pressure time. And Chekhov is encouraged by the fact, of course, he also gets glimpses of, oh my God, what Rilo is doing aboard the Enterprise.
Yeah,
but going back and rewatching Turnabout and seeing how. Yeah, the effect did start to wear off over time, and you have this sort of seesaw effect. I thought, okay, well, I can have a lot of fun with that. And as you know, I milked that for all it was worth. Okay. The one thing I had to change was Turnabout implied that the only way to make it permanent was to, kill Captain Kirk. It starts to switch back and forth. Well, we have to keep, if we kill Captain Kirk, then Janis Lester gets to keep Kirk's body indefinitely. That did not work for my plot. And, this was brand new experimental technology, so I actually have someone explicitly say, contrary to what Dr. Lester believed, it turns out that, it turns out that killing one person will kill the other one because there's a psychic link between them. That was simply to explain, why don't the bad guys just kill Chekhov after they switched his body? It turns out that's a bad thing. And I explicitly say that, Federation researchers who have been studying the turnabout device for 20 years now, turns out that Dr. Lester had it wrong. So, fine.
Yeah.
It wasn't an error. I thought, okay, that doesn't work for my story. So, and again, I think it makes sense. It was,
Yeah.
I've yet to see somebody say that, you broke the rules. No. It was brand new experimental, untested technology. Dr. Lester had this crazy theory that killing Kirk would let her keep the body permanently. Turns out she was wrong.
Yeah.
We move on. It's odd to do a sequel to Turnabout Intruder, but again, I fell over myself to say that this is not Turnabout Intruder Part 2. It's just...
Yeah. It's you want people to buy the book, so...
It's just right. It is not Turnabout Intruder Part 2.
Yeah.
And I was defensive enough to anticipate the sort of pushback from, And incidentally, no one actually came back to me and said, Turnabout Intruder, Greg? Really?
Really?
Are you out of your mind? Although I will say it's one of the few of the original, at this point, of the original 79 episodes. It's one of the few episodes that hasn't got a book sequel yet. Star Trek novels have been around for, at this point, almost as long as Star Trek. And at this point, we have pretty much
Yep.
You know, gone through all the, and I'm part of that. There's very few Trek episodes that we have not mined for novels at this
right.
point. I will confess at this point, I once pitched a Cat's Paw sequel that was, let's just say that was not well received. Okay. Kind of like Cat's Paw, Greg, really? Yeah. And also, Margaret Clark did once actually tell me, and I'm quoting her now, don't even think about Spock's brain, Greg.
I was wondering about that.
she knew me too well. Okay. I have to just get somber for a minute, and I keep mentioning Margaret. Margaret passed away during the writing of this book. That was very sad. She was very heavily involved in the very beginning stages of this book and plotting it. And sadly, she passed away. Honestly, she passed away in about the same time I was supposed to deliver the manuscript. So I'm going to take a moment to mention Margaret and also notice that Margaret had, even though she did not live to see the final manuscript and Scott Pearson took over heroically as the editor of this book under kind of tumultuous circumstances, Margaret's fingerprints are all over this book. She came up with the idea of giving Chekhov a love interest on the Enterprise. And yeah, so I want to know. This is the last book Margaret edited several of my books, and I want to mention her since this will be the last Margaret book. There's a fulsome tribute to her in the back of the book in the acknowledgments, and it was sad to lose her in the middle of this book.
Yeah, I think just talking with some of the other authors, I think her fingerprints are going to continue to be over books. Mm-hmm. Just with as much as she's worked with all of you and everything, and
We did a nice tribute panel to her at Shore Leave this year, which is a fan-run Star Trek convention I go to every year. And there were a bunch of us. We did a whole hour-long tribute to her, And I need to mention also Scott Pearson. Scott Pearson is longtime Star Trek copy editor. He actually has copy edited all of my Star Trek novels, and I think most of the Star Trek novels for the last several years. And when, Margaret passed away somewhat abruptly, he stepped in and took over the editing of Margaret's projects and did a great job. Unfortunately, it was great. It wasn't like thrown into a strange hands. I've known Scott for years. Scott has been the copy editor on Star Trek novels for years, so it was good to know that the book was in good hands. And I'm still editing the Star Trek novels at the moment.
And I know who. I know that Marco Palmieri came back for some of Ring of the David Mack's new book. Did he come back to copy edit yours?
Yes, because indeed, like I said, typically the way it worked, Margaret would edit the books and Scott would copy edit them. But when Scott got drafted to edit the books, we needed somebody to copy edit it, somebody who had experience in new Star Trek. So yes, Marco Palmieri, whom I have worked with, who I've known forever, brought in again in sort of, all hands on board emergency situation to do the copy edit, which is great because, again, I'd known Marco for years. Marco was edited some of my earlier Star Trek books. I've worked with him on other projects. I recently worked on a big Western project with him. So it was fun. It was sad circumstances, but yes, the Star Trek book community came together to keep everything kind of, on track. We got thrown for a very sad loop,
Yeah.
So do you have any projects that you're currently working on that you can at least talk about?
Yes.
And also, can you tell us where people should follow you online?
Short version. Nothing new I can talk about on the Star Trek front at the moment. I have two books coming out. I have, in February, I'm actually going to be the guest of honor at BossCon, which is a venerable Star Trek convention in Boston, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And in conjunction with that, they're publishing a book called Dubious Pleasures, which is a collection of all of my original short stories written over the course of 40 years. For obvious legal reasons, it does not contain any of the stories I have written for various intellectual properties. Mm-hmm. No Star Trek, Buffy, Xena, etc. So all my, scant collection of original short stories that I've written over the course of 40 years, they're putting out this very beautiful deluxe little limited edition signed book, which will be available at the convention and probably elsewhere too. And beyond that, I don't have a pub date for it yet. I have a big horror novel titled Hungry as the Grave, which is coming out from Blackstone Publishing. It's still being edited. I delivered, you know, the last round of revisions a while ago. And that's coming out from Blackstone. It's part of their Weird Tales Presents imprint. Blackstone, which is a large audiobook company that is now venturing into, you know, dead tree books as well, has an imprint, you know, Weird Tales being the venerable, legendary old horror magazine. They now have a Weird Tales imprint they're publishing novels under. And I have written this great big 130,000 word horror novel that, like I said, is currently working its way through the editorial process as we speak. And trust me, once I find out, you know, what its pub date is, I will be shouting it from the rafters. And again, I hang out on a lot of Trek. On Facebook, I belong to more Trek fan groups and Trek book groups than I can think of, keep track of. I've got science fiction groups. I'm on the Trek BBS, often in the Trek book section all the time. I'm on Facebook. And I will say, I am kind of excited about Hungry as the Grave because, believe it or not, this is my first original novel. Only took me 66 years. but again, I was joking, this is a good problem to have. But I have never actually published an original novel, which has occasionally been awkward when I've been doing interviews like this. And so, Mr. Cox, tell us about your original novels. My what? Yeah. And that's because I had the very enviable problem of, you know, Star Trek and CSI and the Library of and Planet of the Apes of being, you know, writing tie-in novels for various different intellectual property has kept me very busy for the last several years. And what actually happened is every year it was like, okay, my New Year's resolution, I'm going to write that original novel I keep threatening to write. And then someone calls and tells me, you know, hey, Greg, how would you like to write the Godzilla novelization? How would you like to write the, you know, new Superman movie novelization? Well, twist my arm, why don't you?
Right.
And I'm not trying to make it sound like this was a hardship, you know. Yeah. Oh, no, make me write a Planet of the Apes novelization. Oh, Greg, would you like to write another Star Trek novel? Sure. But as a result, you know, then what finally happened is the pandemic. The pandemic hit. Everything kind of shut down for a while there. I'm sequestered at home. And there was sort of a sense of, okay, if ever I'm going to write an original novel, now is the time to do it. Mm. I joke, some people learned to make sourdough, you know, well, some of us sat down and wrote a horror novel. So that's when I wrote Hungry the Grave. And so, yeah, I'm finally going to have an original novel come out from Blackstone at some time.
Awesome.
And I like to think there will be more Star Trek in the future. I have nothing I can talk about specifically right now.
Yeah, well, we definitely will look forward to more Star Trek, and yeah, we'll be on the lookout for that book from Blackstone. We love reading other fiction from our favorite authors, so yeah. But Greg, it's been so great having you here and getting a chance to read your new book. And for any listeners out there, definitely go pick it up. You got a little bit of time left before Christmas here, and it'd make a great little stocking stuffer. But Greg, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this with us.
Oh, I'm glad you like the book. And yeah, as I always tell people when I'm doing book signings around Christmas time, that, you know, even if you aren't a Trekkie, you have a nephew, you have a brother, you have a father. In fact, it's funny, as I write TOS books, just to take a second here, because TOS is, you know, 60 years old, yay.
Yeah.
I did a signing recently. It was funny how many people came up to me, well, you know, my dad really loves that show. My mom loves that show. Oh, you know, my dad loves it. It became a bit of a running joke of how many nice young people came up to me and, you know, my dad would like this book.
You know, we're coming up on the grandparent age soon.
Yeah, exactly. My grandpa loves that old show, you know. So.
Yeah.
Hey, that's fine with me. So, you know.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks, Greg.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Well, I love it when we get these interviews with authors that get just And like Greg and some of the other ones you and I talked on the other side of the page about, you just kind of ask them a question. We just let them go.
Yes. You know, we promised some kind of body switching stuff, and Greg delivered. So since we hinted at that, you can call that for this episode, Chekhov's gun.
There you go. Oh, nice. Very good. Yeah, it's funny. It never really occurred to me that, you know, he mentioned a couple times how they write these books and then they sit there for like a year while they're going through the editing and publishing and everything, and then they're waiting for the release dates, and he's not allowed to talk about them, and, you know, just letting the authors loose to just talk about the books and everything, and about writing them. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And we have something planned for our next episode. We know what it is. We will reveal that at some point.
When the episode comes out?
When the episode comes out, yeah. Yeah. We don't want to make too many promises, but if it works out, it would be a big deal.
Got something special lined up, not a specific book. So there's no homework for next time specifically. Yeah, get a little bit of a breather. But yeah, for our January 2026 episode, we're hoping to and planning to have a special thing, and something we haven't done on Literary Treks in a very long time. I would say 2014 was when we last did something that we were planning on doing, and there was actually a hint to what it might be in the interview that we just did with Craig. So, we'll leave it at that. And while people are mulling that over, and or maybe have already shut off the episode after the rambling, why don't you tell people where they can find you?
You can find me on YouTube. That's my primary place. My YouTube channel name is Jonathan Cohn, K-O-A-N. You can find all my Star Trek book reviews on Goodreads and on YouTube there. I'm on Facebook and Twitter as well. Twitter is probably the best place to see all my ramblings and my many arguments I get into with people. I am in the Goodreads group. I am not as active as I should be, but I'm in that Goodreads group. And like you, I also need to get into the Facebook group more often.
Yes. Well, you can find me on Goodreads at Knitting Trekkie. You can find me poking around in the Babel Conference on Facebook and some of those other groups that, you know, Greg mentioned. I'm a member of a few of them and usually just lurk around and like things. You can find my blog, which just mirrors the reviews that are on Goodreads. But if you want to find that, it's bookbusterreviews.com.
Speaking of which,
by the time our next episode drops, I think my YouTube channel should be live. Woo-hoo! The channel's live, but should actually have a couple of videos on it. I've got one fully edited, which is like 2 minutes, just the intro, welcome to the channel kind of thing. But I am in the middle of editing what will probably be my first video and get a couple up there in December, I'm hoping, and then that way I can start releasing a little bit more regularly starting in January. Not super regularly at first, but we'll get into it. But
you guys can't be the first subscriber, because I've already subscribed, but
yeah, it's true.
I want to see who can be next.
But yes, you can find me on YouTube at Bookbuster Reviews, and that'll be a lot of fun. So anyway, enough of that. It's a good episode. Yes. Yeah. And I'm just totally lost my train of thought, but thank you, everyone, for listening. And until next time, live long
and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.